The Author Meets the Critic. It's The Author Meets the Critics, the original program where the author of a new book meets and exchanges his opinions with his severest critics, the nation's top book reviewers. And now here's the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you, Ken Banghart. A few years ago, many of the top-flight literary critics devoted a great deal of space to welcoming a first novel by a new young writer. The novel was What Makes Sammy Run and the author Bud Schulberg. 2 weeks ago, there appeared a new book by the same Bud Schulberg. It is called The Harder They Fall, and it's a hard-hitting story of the prize fight business, or in the words of the publishers, the fight racket. Mr. Schulberg is with us this afternoon, and he is prepared to meet his critics face-to-face. Here first is the book review editor of the New York World Telegram, an old friend of this program, Mr. Harry Hansen.
The Harder They Fall is a straight-shooting, frank story of the fixed fight racket. I know nothing about prize fights, so I judge this book on its merits as a novel. It is both illuminating and entertaining, but it asks you to stretch your belief in it to the breaking point. We are asked to believe that Nick Latka, a dishonest and ruthless promoter, can build up Toro Molina, a big, flabby Argentine, into a huge box office attraction merely by bribing better fighters to lie down and take the count. Molina has nothing but size. He is an illiterate, overgrown baby. We also have to believe that Nick robs Molina of everything he earns except $49.07. That I can believe, but I am skeptical about big slices of this book. Practically everybody in it is a crook, a heel, a two-timer, or a sap.
Well, on the other side of the fence, with quite a different opinion, and no two-timer, heel, or sap, is our other critic, another friend of this program, the executive director of the Society for the Prevention of Crime, Mr. Edwin J. Lucas.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, I like The Harder They Fall enormously, because Mr. Schulberg succeeded, at least for me, in developing its principal characters colorfully and credibly. The ugly pictures of these two-fisted people were drawn two-fistedly. They came alive out of the action-packed pages of the book, and to me they seemed real. Additionally, whenever the author of a book succeeds in illuminating my mind concerning a new fact of life in the world in which I live, I'm grateful. This Mr. Schulberg has done eminently well, and will do for thousands of others who read this book. He has skillfully penetrated the seemingly tough skins and forbidding mannerisms of the strange people who are identified with the prize fight racket, and has shown them to be ordinary human beings with all the common weaknesses of people like you and like me. For example, there's touching sentimentality here, but there's also lust and larceny. Essentially, these people differ from the rest of us only to the degree that they fail to conceal their frailties behind a veneer of respectability.
Well, there you have the critics' points of view. We'll let them tangle in a little while, and later in the program we will hear from Bud Schulberg himself. But first, here is a word from Kenneth Banghart.
This series of broadcasts, sponsored by the Book of the Month Club, is directed to everyone interested in good books, and particularly to the thousands of members of the Book of the Month Club in this area. The book to be discussed today is The Harder They Fall by Bud Schulberg, one of the nearly 50 books now being offered to members as alternate selections. Any of these books may be chosen in addition to or in place of the regular Book of the Month, and they earn the same credit as Books of the Month. These alternate books are chosen to serve the wide variety of literary tastes and interests of members of the club. And the list includes such books as Thunder Out of China by Theodore H. White and Annalee Jacoby, and The Steeper Cliff by David Davidson, both of which, by the way, were reviewed recently on our Sunday program. Other books on our alternate list are East River by Shola Mash, Gentleman's Agreement by Laura Z. Hobson, and The Gladiators, the first novel by Arthur Kessler to be printed in this country. These books can, of course, be secured at any time by members through the Book of the Month Club and by anyone at the local bookstores. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Well, gentlemen, at least we have a very clear-cut difference of opinion. Mr. Hansen can't believe this book. He doesn't believe that you can take this fighter from South America who has no talent whatsoever, who is illiterate. I'm not sure that literacy is relevant to skill in the ring, Mr. Hansen, but that you can build him up by having people go into the tank for him, as the phrase goes, I believe, that you can build him up by publicity into a contender for the heavyweight championship. Now, Mr. Lucas, on the other hand, believes these things. Of course, he deals with crime all the time, and maybe he's prepared to believe these things by nature and by personal psychology. But, Mr. Lucas, would you care to comment on the believability of this story?
Well, yes. I'm not suggesting, Mr. McCaffrey, and I didn't mean to suggest before, that I met these characters before or that I intend...
Oh, perish forbid.
But I believe them. But the reason I think I believe them is that having gotten only slight symptoms of this behavior in my everyday life, Schulberg made me believe that these people can be saps, heels, crooks, and two-timers, as Mr. Hansen suggested they seemed to him to be. And I get evidence of their two-timingness, their crookedness, and their heelness in a great deal of the other behavior to which I've been exposed on the part of these people who people Mr. Schulberg's book.
Mr. Hansen.
Well, Mr. Lucas, I didn't mean to call for moralizing in the book or for any great lesson. I think the object of the novelist is to make us feel these people, to understand them, to know their problem. There is no character in the book that you can identify yourself with or whose problem you can really feel from the inside. Eddie Lewis is a young writer of publicity from Princeton who is there to do the job for the money that's in it. He has a girl named Beth who is a decent character, and he hopes someday to marry. But Beth says, you can't stay with this racket, you'll be soiled. And he says, well, I think I can, and I know that Nick isn't any good, but I'm going to stay with it. Now, there was a man who had a problem in his heart and in his mind, but the problem doesn't come through. It is always secondary to the problem of Toro Molino. Molino doesn't come through. The problem is secondary to that of Nick Latka, and Nick Latka is all over the place, but what is going on inside of Nick?
Well, I think we should go here. The Toro Molina is the prize fighter who has been brought up from South America and is being conned into a contender. In many reviews of this book, Mr. Molina was compared to a prize fighter who was brought up from somewhere and who did become a contender of sorts. We won't mention his name, and no one, of course, knows to whom I am referring. However, that analogy has been made between the character in the book, Toro Molina, and an actual character. Nick Latka is the promoter, the man who is behind the scenes of this fantastic and perfectly, completely dishonest business of bringing up Molina so that people will go to see him. And that is, as Mr. Hansen has pointed out, the main theme going through the book, is Latka's machinations to get Toro Molina up to where he really brings in money. Of course, there are other characters in the book, such as Ruby, Nick's wife, who seems so respectable, is why Nick likes her. In the book, she is not quite as respectable as Nick believes her to be. I think that's as far as we can describe Ruby on the air. Further than that, we've done very well with describing Princeton men. I don't know why you should laugh about Ruby. At any rate, there are the numbers of handlers and men who are the hangers-on, the trainers, the sparring partners of the fight racket. Now, Mr. Lucas, as a story, Mr. Hansen has severely criticized the fact that none of these people stand up. Their problems aren't solved. Where does Nick Latka get, for instance?
Well, I was chiefly interested, frankly, in neither Nick Latka, nor Toro, nor Ruby, nor the handlers, but in Eddie himself. Eddie is the narrator of the story. Eddie is the press agent for Nick, the press agent for Toro. Eddie is the man who takes this clumsy lummox from the Andes and makes of him the man mountain of the Andes, a person who, as he said at one point in the book, is being sold pretty much as an advertising agency sells soap or toothpaste. He gets the public to accept Toro. But to me, the pathetic creature in the book was Eddie. Eddie in conflict. Eddie, this Princeton poet. Eddie, this man who wanted to be a playwright, who indeed had, I think, one or two acts of a play written and stored away somewhere, yellowing in the bottom drawer of his dresser.
Now, just a minute, Mr. Lucas. You're waxing lyrical on the subject of Eddie, and I think that you're giving the audience a perfectly... and completely inaccurate picture of him, this Princeton poet. Well, maybe that is accurate. I don't know so many poets out of Princeton. But we get this young man...
Maybe it isn't accurate. Maybe there aren't many poets out of Princeton. But he wanted to be a poet, and that was the important thing.
But the point was that in the end, Eddie just didn't have it. You're sentimentalizing Eddie. Eddie was merely a man who was a $125 a week press agent at his best, mind you, and who had the morals, the attitudes of the $125 a week press agent, and the uncompleted play, the uncompleted poems, don't make him this pastoral character that you began on when I so rudely interrupted you.
Well, now, I refrain from rudely interrupting you, but I'm going to ask you now, what do you mean by the morals of a $125-a-week press agent? What are they?
Well, if, after having read the book, you're not able to answer that for yourself, Mr. Lucas, I hesitate in this half hour to go into it. Here is a man who lends himself to the exploitation... the dishonest exploitation of a person who has no business entertaining people even in a prize ring.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, all through the book, Eddie Lewis is apologizing for himself. The trouble that he faces is entirely one of justifying himself to Beth. But he is constantly saying, I think it's swell to have this money, and I'm going to have $600 a month finally, and $20,000 a year eventually. And I think that after all, I ought to stick it out. It's never a case of saying I might... make same honest money with the play or with books. He definitely likes this racket.
Well, liking and being drawn into it and being unable to extricate himself are two entirely different things. I didn't get the feeling that Eddie liked this racket at all. I got the feeling instead that he hated every moment of it.
Why didn't he go back to newspaper work? He'd been able to make a living at it then, hadn't he?
Because, as he himself said almost in this language, and as Mr. Schulberg probably will make even clearer when he's given his inning, Eddie was the victim of his own poetry. Eddie believed that building up Toro to the point at which he could be sold like soap or toothpaste was the point at which Eddie was going to be able to withdraw to write his poetry. Now, the trouble with Eddie was that he underrated himself and he underrated Nick, and of course, in his advertising, he overrated Toro. He was a pathetic creature who, to use a colloquialism, was too weak to extricate himself. But he knew better. In fact, at the very end, he makes it clear that he knew better. He knew better all the while. That's what makes him so pathetic.
Mr. Lucas, on the basis of that statement, I am willing to accept the fact that the greatest thing in the artistic experience is the imagination of the reader. If you have been able to create this character of Eddie out of the person that Mr. Schulberg presented in the book, I think you should be writing your novels yourself. You have a great talent for fiction. Mr. Hansen.
Well, may I add this one little point that Eddie Lewis, this wonderful guy that wants to get out of this business, is able to two-time his own girl, Beth, and go around and sit around with Shirley, who, after all, isn't the sort of...
Ready and able, I think, is the phrase, isn't it, Mr.
Ready
Hansen?
And able, and then feeling it's quite
Eddie,
good company.
Eddie Lucas is close enough to Eddie Lewis for me to say that I resent that in Eddie Lewis's behalf. I don't think he two-timed Beth at all. I think Eddie was living the double life of a tortured, conflicted person. Now, I may be, as I did once before several months ago on this program, be reading into the author's mind something that wasn't intended at all. And again, I repeat, Schulberg is going to tell us about this later. But in any case, this is what I got out of the book. And what I got out of the book is what I've been asked to say.
Well, I think that the only thing that we can do logically is perhaps bring on Mr. Schulberg, because I think we've heard enough now from the critic's side, and it is time to turn to our author of the afternoon, Mr. Bud Schulberg. Mr. Schulberg, what do you think of our presentation of Eddie Lewis, the poet of Princeton?
Well, I've been quite interested in it, Mr. McCaffrey.
That's kind of you.
You know, I suppose it's a strange thing about authors, especially when their own books are being discussed. They listen to all the arguments very carefully, and they weigh the evidence with as much judiciousness as they can. And then, looking at it objectively, they seem to agree with the person who likes their book. And yet, I don't agree altogether with Mr. Lucas's interpretation of Eddie. And I think Mr. Hansen's interpretation of Eddie, and incidentally the interpretation of one or two other critics which I've read lately, seems to be even more sentimental than mine.
No, Mr.
I wasn't... excuse me. I wasn't really so interested in whether Eddie Lewis would ever quit the boxing business and write a book or not, or a play or anything else. I thought he probably was justifying himself and indulging in the kind of pipe dreams that many, many people do, especially when they're connected with something that is evil and don't want to face the fact that they are as evil as the thing that they're actually touching.
Well, I wonder if we could settle for him as the poet of Princeton Junction.
No, I won't even settle for that. No, I don't see him quite as the poet of Princeton. I at least tried to write him as someone who really sees something that is evil, knows that it's evil, and yet is too weak to do anything about it. In other words, instead of really taking some action against it, he simply goes along for the ride and profits from it.
Well, is that the reason to you, Mr. Lucas? Is that the way you see this character? That it's just the dough, the 125, the bonus which is going to come, and then the $20,000? Is that the way you see Eddie?
No, not at all. I can say about Schulberg is that he had the intuitive wisdom to give Eddie Lewis another side. A side that appealed to me enormously. Sure, he went along for the ride, but he had one object in view all the time. Either that, Schulberg, or on too many pages of your book, I found the temptation on your part to indicate that at a certain point in his career, Eddie was going to get off the wagon. He was no longer going to ride. Now, was I wrong about that?
Not entirely, no, but what I felt was even more important for him than writing a play or not was the enormity of his own crime, which is to see something and not do anything about it.
Well, now, I'd like to do a little moral assessing here, and Harry, you've said that you don't want any moralizing on this program, but here we have a number of people who have conspired to put Toro Molina into a prize ring, and people, if I know the 20th century boxing business well enough, would be charged anywhere from $30 to $100 for a ringside seat to put Toro Molina into a ring. And he's helpless, he's victimized, everybody who goes to see him is victimized. Now, there's Nick Blatka, the promoter, there's Eddie Lewis, who writes the publicity, there are the handlers and trainers who train him. What about their moral responsibility, and is Eddie the worst criminal of the book? Is he the biggest villain of the book to you, Mr. Hansen?
No, he is not the biggest villain. I think we've gotten a little off that subject by talking too much about Eddie. The biggest villain, of course, is Nick Blatka, who has absolutely no morals or any feeling about it. Nick could turn from one thing to another. As he says, this is easier. He can make more money in this than in running roulette or something of that kind. And Nick is out for the money. But the thing I do want to stress is this, that I don't think that Toro Molina is credible as a character because he is made to be a man that can almost be pushed over by a tap on the wrist right straight through the book. And that is only when he goes haywire, beats up an innocent man or innocent, not so much as an unfortunate man who can no longer defend himself.
There is a difference between the two.
That he has any punch whatsoever, and of course knocks him out by hitting him on the skull and killing him.
Do you? How do you feel about this unbelievability of this man Mountain, who has no punch and no ability to defend himself, but when he really gets worked up with one Leonard, he killed him, Mr.
You're
Lucas.
Asking me? Oh, I that was believable, and of course I find myself in agreement with Mr. Hansen, at long last, Toro in this book represents the sadism, the brutality in man. The natural, almost instinctive aggressiveness of people, of course, finds an outlet in the brutality of prize fighters. And their sadism is nowhere more clearly exhibited than in the yells they give forth in these prize fights to kill the adversary. Always kill the adversary. Not just maim him or wound him, but kill him. And the professionals in the fight business, Nick Blatka and his coterie of lieutenants, cash in on this psychological phenomenon. I think Schulberg made that abundantly clear.
Well, one of the scenes that was certainly the most effective in the book was where the second was fighting out on the coast, and the repetition of the cries from the crowd. Interestingly enough, the use of every ugly racial word, every sadistic, ugly, and brutal word came from the crowd. It seemed to me that Mr. Schulberg was pointing out very sharply there that a good deal of the brutality of the prize ring, the actual sadism and brutality, does not rest with the professionals such as George, who was just a sparring partner, but it rests with the people who watch.
which maybe has some overtones, which might refer to other people who watch when things are going on in the world. Mr. Schulberg, what about that?
Well, I agree with you very strongly about that. In fact, I was talking to Mickey Walker this morning, one of the really greatest of living fighters, and I was impressed, as I've been impressed by talking to so many fighters, with the real tranquility of their personalities. I mean, there's nothing essentially vicious about them, of course, but there is a great deal of viciousness in the spectator sport of boxing, I believe.
You've watched a good many fights yourself, have you, Mr. Schulberg?
Oh, from way back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, from way back. I take it that you don't get along with Mr. Strauss or
Mr. Jacobs. I keep on
Jacobs.
Going.
you keep on going.
I still like it.
Well, I tend to feel that Mr. Hansen has quite a point here, in that how can you... I couldn't stir up either a great deal of sympathy for either Eddie or for Toro Molina. I felt Toro Molina would have been victimized no matter where he was. I'm sorry that he was victimized, but I couldn't feel that you had a really terrible thing to work on. You wasted, it seems to me, a great deal of indignation on a subject that wasn't strong enough. Now, Mr. Lucas, on the other hand, feels that this is a poignant story with stories for our times in it.
Well, now, Mr. McCaffrey, there was no law legislated or in the moral code of man which required Acosta, was that the name of the promoter who found Toro,
mm-hmm.
to take him out of the wine-growing country of the Argentine, take him out of the vineyards and bring him to this big bad city and make of him a man-mountain fighter. In other words, I say that bringing Toro here was the first evil, the first crime exhibited in this book. It's believable to me, and it's been done. You, as a matter of fact, Mr. McCaffrey, only a few moments ago, suggested that it was done in the case of an actual fighter whom Toro is supposed to represent in this book.
Oh, just the merest hint of a suggestion, Mr. Luke. Just the merest.
A suggestion which left everybody in this audience well aware as to whom you referred to.
Oh, it was a very subtle thing. It was very subtle.
Now, therefore, it was done. Therefore, if it's done again by Schulberg in The Harder They Fall, what's incredible about it? So the very first step in this book that was taken by a character is believable. And from that point forward, I have no difficulty in believing everything that happened to him.
Mr. Lucas, I realize there have been phony fights, and I understand the prize fighter that we are referring to who had two or three of them. Toro Molino has practically nothing but phony fights right straight through the book. I mean, he shows there's no possible reason for hitting Tony Molina.
No, except for the fact that everybody surrounding him from the very start, with the possible exception of Eddie Lewis, whom I'm always going to reserve from this category, were phonies. Now, if they were all phonies, why shouldn't every fight that Toro fought be a phony?
Well, no, there's something to ponder.
Well, I certainly would agree that every fight isn't fixed, far from it, and that every fighter isn't as big a phony as Toro Molina. Maybe that's a big admission, but I was interested in something really beyond that. I think in the last 50 years or even more, that there has been a great change in the nature of the prize fight business itself. In other words, that whereas in the old days people fought purses with all to win, and if they lost, they lost everything. Today, I think it's become a big business. And I was interested in boxing as an aspect, really, of big business, and simply took one example, which for me was the best example. It's not the only example, and of course there are some others that may refute it.
Well, there's where I'd criticize you, Mr. Schulberg. I feel that when you wrote What Makes Sammy Run, here was a book that hit a tremendous chord all over the country. Everybody who read it said, he caught this, he has done it, he has caught this type of character, the grasping person always running after the completely ephemeral, the material, the gross, the sordid things in life. And the whole picture that you presented was something that has become a classic. Sammy, he's a Sammy as a person. It's gone into the language. And now that in writing this book, instead of finding the person who became the type, you have taken the types to find the person. And it seems to me that you've given us types throughout. These are types of people in the prize fight racket. And they are stereotypes of that rather than real people. Now, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'd try to answer it. Of course, the final answer is up to each reader. It's up to you and the others. I could never really answer it. I wouldn't even try to. But the final answer, at least for me, does lie with Eddie Lewis, and so I keep coming back to him. I think that what he does is quite typical of what many people do, not only in boxing, but in many other fields as well, in advertising, in screenwriting, in a dozen different businesses where they are a little better, but not a great deal better than the thing they're doing. And so they're able to go on doing it with the justification that they really will get out of it and do something socially useful. I think there are maybe as many people like that as those who have been identified with Sammy. I don't know.
Mr. Lucas, do you want to make still another pitch for Eddie Lewis, this poet of the prize ring?
I think I've pitched enough for him, but I'd like to undertake, if I have a moment, to answer the thing that Mr. Schulberg said he couldn't at the moment answer. You spoke, Mr. McCaffrey, of the fact that these people stood out as types. Now, I know you didn't mean to suggest that they necessarily typified people in the prize fight business, because there are plenty of them who are, I don't know how they achieve it, but who are respectable. What Schulberg did here, again, I may be crediting him with a lot of intuitive wisdom that he didn't have in mind to portray. But in any case, what he did here was to select one of each. He selected one manager, and that was Nick. Nick was a phony. That's too bad. Too bad for Toro. He selected Toro. Toro was a phony, but he didn't intend to be, really. He didn't know better. He selected Vince, that phony of all phonies, that fixer.
Well, you don't have to go through the calendar. Get
well
the
now. All right. All right. Having selected those people to delineate, it seems to me, he had to make of them exactly what kind of people they were, the kind of people who were phonies. And I don't suggest, I don't think Mr. Schulberg suggests, that they are necessarily typical of everybody in the business. But they were believable.
And to you, were they as believable as Rocky Graziano, Mr. Hanson?
Well, is he a musician or a fighter?
there perhaps we have the key to your criticism. I'm sorry, gentlemen, but time's up now for both the author and the critics, and I'll be back in a minute to tell you about next week's program. But first, here is a word from Ken Banghart.
Our book discussed today in the last program sponsored by the Book of the Month Club, The Harder They Fall, was recently published by Random House. It's a hard-hitting novel about the prize-fighting world by the author of the widely discussed book, What Makes Sammy Run? It was received with enthusiasm by the editorial department of the Book of the Month Club when, along with several hundred other books, it was read for submission to the judges as a possible Book of the Month. In the opinion of the editorial board, The Harder They Fall is a story of profound depth and significance shaped out of a sweat-laden atmosphere of brutality and cynicism. While it wasn't selected as a Book of the Month, it was added to the growing list of books which present members of the Book of the Month Club can choose in addition to or in place of the regular monthly selection. Special members' editions of nearly 50 popular important books are now available in this way, as part of a plan to help satisfy the literary tastes of the hundreds of thousands of families who now belong to the club, and who wish to read an important book each month, even though the regular selection may not appeal to them. This growing list of books is included each month in the special supplement to the Book of the Month Club News. Each month, the news reviews the current selection and reports on many other important books. Books which may be secured either through the club or through your local bookstore. If you're not now a member of the club, you may get a free copy of the current issue of the Book of the Month Club News by writing to the Book of the Month Club, care of WNBC, New York 20, New York. And now, John McCaffrey, what lies ahead for The Author Meets the Critics?
Next week, we hope to bring you the inside story of the American occupation of Japan. We will be talking about one of the most controversial books of the year, Star Spangled Mikado by Frank Kelly and Cornelius Ryan. The Star-Spangled Mikado, one need hardly explain, is General Douglas MacArthur, and the General is one personality we can always count on to provoke an argument. 2 weeks from this afternoon, we are looking forward to one of the most exciting programs we have ever had on The Author Meets the Critics, when our author of the afternoon will be Edward J. Flynn, the man who has ruled politics in the borough of the Bronx for a quarter of a century, and who was chairman of the Democratic National Committee under Franklin D. Roosevelt. The book is Mr. Flynn's new one, and is entitled You're the Boss. And now, before closing, I'd like to thank Bud Schulberg for coming here to defend his new book, The Harder They Fall, and to thank you, Harry Hansen, and Edwin J. Lucas, for joining us. This is John K. M. McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.